Books on Tape presents Blowfly, written by Patricia Cornwell. Read by Kate Redding. To Dr. Louis Cataldi, coroner of East Baton Rouge Parish, a man of excellence, honor, humanity, and truth, the world is a better place because of you. They shall lie down alike in the dust, and the worms shall cover them. Job 21:26. 1. Dr. K. Scarpetta moves the tiny glass vial close to candlelight, illuminating a maggot drifting in a poisonous bath of ethanol. At a glance, she knows the exact stage of metamorphosis before the creamy carcass, no larger than a grain of rice, was preserved in a specimen vessel fitted with a black screw cap. Had the larva lived, it would have matured into a blue bottle, Calophora vicina, a blowfly. It might have laid its eggs in a dead human body's mouth or eyes, or in a living person's malodorous wounds. "Thank you very much," Scarpetta says, looking around the table at the 14 cops and crime scene technicians of the National Forensic Academy's class of 2003. Her eyes linger on Nick Robillard's innocent face. "I don't know who collected this from a location best not to contemplate at the dinner table and preserved it with me in mind, but—" Blank looks and shrugs. "I have to say that this is the first time I've been given a maggot as a gift." No one claims responsibility, but if there is a fact Scarpetta has never doubted, it is a cop's ability to bluff and, when necessary, outright lie. Having noticed a tug at the corner of Nick Robillard's mouth before anyone else realized that a maggot had joined them at the dinner table, Scarpetta has a suspect in mind. The light of the flame moves over the vial in Scarpetta's fingertips, her nails neatly filed short and square, her hands steady and elegant, but strong from years of manipulating the unwilling dead and cutting through their stubborn tissue and bone. Unfortunately for Nick, her classmates aren't laughing, and humiliation finds her like a frigid draft. After 10 weeks with cops she should now count as comrades and friends, she is still Nick the Hick from Zachary, Louisiana, a town of 12,000, where until recently murder was an almost unheard-of atrocity. It was not unusual for Zachary to go for years without one. Most of Nick's classmates are so jaded by working homicides that they have come up with their own categories for them. Real murders, misdemeanor murders, even urban renewal. Nick doesn't have her own pet categories. Murder is murder. So far in her 8-year career, she has worked only 2, both of them domestic shootings. It was awful the first day of class when an instructor went from one cop to another, asking how many homicides each of their departments averaged a year. "None," Nick said. Then he asked the size of each cop's department. 35, Nick said. Or, smaller than my 8th grade class, as one of her new classmates put it. From the beginning of what was supposed to be the greatest opportunity of her life, Nick quit trying to fit in, accepting that in the police way of defining the universe she was a them, not an us. Her rather whimsical maggot mischief, she realizes with regret, was a breach of something, she's not sure what. But without a doubt she should never have decided to give a gift, serious or otherwise, to the legendary forensic pathologist, Dr. K. Scarpetta. Nick's face heats up, and a cold sweat dampens her armpits as she watches for her hero's reaction, unable to read it, probably because Nick is stunned stupid by insecurity and embarrassment. "So I'll call her Maggie, although we really can't determine gender yet," Scarpetta decides, her wire-rim glasses reflecting shifting candlelight. "But a good enough name for a maggot, I think." A ceiling fan snaps and whips the candle flame inside its glass globe as she holds up the vial. "Who's going to tell me which instar Maggie is? What life stage was she in before someone," she scans the faces at the table, pausing on Nick's again, "dropped her in this little bottle of ethanol? And, by the way, I suspect Maggie aspirated and drowned. Maggots need air the same way we do." "What asshole drowned a maggot?" one of the cops snipes.
"Yeah, imagine inhaling alcohol."
What you talking about, Joey? You've been inhaling it all night. A dark, ominous humor begins to rumble like a distant storm, and Nick doesn't know how to duck out of it. She leans back in her chair, crossing her arms at her chest, doing her best to look indifferently as her mind unexpectedly plays one of her father's worn-out storm warnings.
Now, Nick, honey, when there's lightning, don't stand alone or think you'll be protected by hiding in the trees. Find the nearest ditch and lie as low in it as you can.
At the moment, she has no place to hide but in her own silence.
Hey, Doc, we already took our last test. Who brought homework to our party?
Yeah, we're off duty.
Off duty, I see, Scarpetta muses. So if you're off duty when the dead body of a missing person has just been found, you're not going to respond. Is that what you're saying?
I'd have to wait until my bourbon wears off, says a cop whose shaved head is so shiny it looks waxed.
That's a thought, she says. Now the cops are laughing, everyone but Nick. It can happen. Scarpetta sets the vial next to her wine glass. At any given moment, we can get a call. It may prove to be the worst call of our careers, and here we are, slightly buzzed from a few drinks on our time off, or maybe sick, or in the middle of a fight with a lover, a friend, one of the kids. She pushes away her half-eaten yellowfin tuna and folds her hands on top of the checkered tablecloth. But cases can't wait, she adds.
Seriously, isn't it true that some can?
Asks a Chicago detective his classmates call Popeye because of the anchor tattooed on his left forearm.
Like bones in a well or buried in a basement? Or a body under a slab of concrete? I mean, they ain't going anywhere.
The dead are impatient, Scarpetta says. 2. Night on the bayou reminds Jay Talley of a Cajun band of bullfrogs playing bass and peepers screaming on electric guitars and cicadas and crickets rasping washboards and sawing fiddles. He shines a flashlight near the dark, arthritic shape of an old cypress tree, and alligator eyes flash and vanish beneath black water. The light simmers with the ominous soft sound of mosquitoes as the bay stealth drifts, the outboard motor cut. Jay sits in the captain's chair and idly surveys the woman in the fish box not far below his feet. When he was boat shopping several years ago, this particular bay stealth excited him. The fish box beneath the floor is long and deep enough to hold more than 120 pounds of ice and fish. Or a woman, built the way he likes. Her wide, panicked eyes shine in the dark. In daylight, they are blue, a deep, beautiful blue. She painfully screws them shut as Jay caresses her with the beam of the flashlight, starting with her mature, pretty face, all the way down to her red, painted toenails. She is blonde, probably in her early to mid-40s, but looks younger than that. Petite, but curvaceous. The fiberglass fish box is lined with orange boat cushions, dirty and stained black from old blood. Jay was thoughtful, even sweet, when he bound her wrists and ankles loosely, so the yellow nylon rope wouldn't cut off her circulation. He told her that the rope wouldn't abrade her soft flesh as long as she didn't struggle.
No point in struggling, anyway, he said in a baritone voice that goes perfectly with his blonde god good looks. And I'm not going to gag you. No point in screaming, either, right?
She nodded her head, which made him laugh, because she was nodding as if answering yes, when of course she meant no. But he understands how haywire people think and act when they are terrified, a word that has always struck him as so completely inadequate. He supposes that when Samuel Johnson was toiling at the many editions of his dictionary, he had no idea what a human being feels when he or she anticipates horror and death. The anticipation creates a frenzy of panic in every neuron, in every cell of the body, that goes far, far beyond mere terror. But even Jay, who is fluent in many languages, has no better word to describe what his victims suffer.
A frisson of horror.
No. He studies the woman. She is a lamb. In life there are only two types of people, wolves and lambs.
Jay's determination to perfectly describe the way his lambs feel has become a relentless, obsessive quest. The hormone epinephrine, adrenaline, is the alchemy that turns a normal person into a lower form of life with no more control or logic than a gigged frog. Added to the physiological response that precipitates what criminologists, psychologists, and other so-called experts refer to as fight or flight, are the additional elements of the lamb's past experiences and imagination. The more violence a lamb has experienced through books, television, movies, or the news, for example, the more the lamb can imagine the nightmare of what might happen. But the word, the perfect word, it eludes him tonight. He gets down on the boat floor and listens to his lamb's rapid, shallow breaths. She trembles as the earthquake of horror, for lack of the perfect word, shifts her every molecule, creating unbearable havoc. He reaches down into the fish box and touches her hand. It is as cold as death. He presses two fingers against the side of her neck, finding her carotid artery and using the luminescent dial of his watch to take her pulse. 180, more or less, he tells her. Don't have a heart attack. I had one who did. She stares at him with eyes bigger than a full moon, her lower lip twitching. I mean it. Don't have a heart attack. He is serious. It is an order. Take a deep breath. She does, her lungs shaky. Better?
Yes. Please.
Why is it that all of you little lambs are so fucking polite? Her dirty magenta cotton shirt had been torn open days ago, and he spreads the ripped front, exposing her more than ample breasts. They tremble and shimmer in the faint light, and he follows their round slopes down to her heaving ribcage, to the hollow of her flat abdomen, down to the unzipped fly of her jeans.
I'm sorry,
she tries to whisper, as a tear rolls down her dirt-streaked face. Now, there you go again. He sits back in his throne of the captain's chair. Do you really, really believe that being polite is going to change my plans? The politeness sets off a slow, burning rage. Do you know what politeness means to me? He expects an answer. She tries to wet her lips, her tongue as dry as paper. Her pulse visibly pounds in her neck as if a tiny bird is trapped in there. No. She chokes on the word, tears flowing into her ears and hair. Weakness, he says. Several frogs strike up the band. Jay studies his prisoner's nakedness, her pale skin shiny with bug repellent, a small humane act on his part, motivated by his distaste for red welts. Mosquitoes are a gray, chaotic storm around her, but do not land. He gets down from his chair again and gives her a sip of bottled water. Most of it runs down her chin. Touching her sexually is of no interest to him. 3 nights now he has brought her out here in his boat because he wants the privacy to talk and stare at her nakedness, hoping that somehow her body will become Kay Scarpetta's and finally becomes furious because it can't. Furious because Scarpetta wouldn't be polite. Furious because Scarpetta isn't weak. A rabid part of him fears he is a failure because Scarpetta is a wolf and he captures only lambs and he can't find the perfect word. The word. He realizes the word will not come to him with this lamb in the fish box, just as it hasn't come with the others. I'm getting bored, he tells his lamb. I'll ask you again. One last chance. What is the word? She swallows hard, her voice reminding him of a broken axle as she tries to move her tongue to speak. He can hear it sticking to her upper palate.
Don't understand. I'm sorry.
Fuck the politeness. Do you hear me? How many times do I have to say it? The tiny bird inside her neck beats frantically and her tears flow faster. What is the word? Tell me what you feel. And don't say scared. You're a goddamn schoolteacher. You must have a vocabulary with more than 5 words in it.
I feel acceptance. She says, sobbing.
You feel what?
You're not going to let me go, she says. I know it now.
3. Scarpetta's subtle wit reminds Nick of heat lightning. It doesn't rip and crack and show off like regular lightning, but is a quiet, shimmering flash that her mother used to tell her meant God was taking pictures.
He takes pictures of everything you're doing, Nick. So you'd better behave yourself, because one day there will be the final judgment, and those pictures are going to be passed around for all to see.
Nick stopped believing such nonsense by the time she reached high school, but her silent partner, as she thinks of her conscience, will probably never stop warning her that her sins will find her out. And Nick believes her sins are many.
Investigator Robillard, Scarpetta is saying.
Nick is startled by the sound of her own name. Her focus returns to the cozy, dark dining room and the cops who fill it.
Tell us what you'd do if your phone rang at 2 a.m. and you'd had a few drinks, but were needed at a bad, really bad crime scene, Scarpetta presents to her. Let me preface this by saying that no one wants to be left out when there's a bad, really bad crime scene. Maybe we don't like to admit that, but it's true.
I don't drink very much.
Nick instantly regrets the remark as her classmates groan.
Lordy, where'd you grow up, girlfriend? Sunday school?
What I mean is I really can't because I have a 5-year-old son.
Nick's voice trails off and she feels like crying. This is the longest she's ever been away from him. The table falls silent. Shame and awkwardness flatten the mood.
Hey, Nick, Popeye says. You got his picture with you? His name's Buddy, he tells Scarpetta. You gotta see his picture. A really ass-kicking little hombre sitting on a pony.
Nick is in no mood to pass around the wallet-sized photograph that by now is worn soft, the writing on the back faded and smeared from her taking it out and looking at it all the time. She wishes Popeye would change the subject, or give her the silent treatment again.
How many of you have children? Scarpetta asks the table. About 12 hands go up.
One of the painful aspects of this work, she points out, maybe the worst thing about this work, or shall I call it a mission, is what it does to the people we love, no matter how hard we try to protect them.
No heat lightning at all. Just a silky black darkness, cool and lovely to the touch, Nick thinks as she watches Scarpetta.
She's gentle.
Behind that wall of fiery fearlessness and brilliance, she's kind and gentle.
In this work, relationships can also become fatalities. Often they do, Scarpetta goes on, always trying to teach, because it is easier for her to share her mind than to touch feelings she is masterful at keeping out of reach.
So, Doc, you got kids?
Reba, a crime scene technician from San Francisco, starts on another whiskey sour. She has begun to slur her words and has no tact. Scarpetta hesitates.
I have a niece.
Oh, yeah, now I remember. Lucy. She's been in the news a lot, or was, I mean.
Stupid drunk idiot, Nick silently protests with a flash of anger.
Yes, Lucy is my niece. Scarpetta replies.
FBI? Computer whiz?
Reba won't stop.
Then what? Let me think. Something about flying helicopters and AFT.
ATF, you stupid drunk.
Thunder cracks in the back of Nick's mind.
I don't know. Wasn't there a big fire or something and someone got killed? So what's she doing now?
She drains her whiskey sour and looks for the waitress.
That was a long time ago.
Scarpetta doesn't answer her questions, and Nick detects a weariness, a sadness, as immutable and maimed as the stumps and knees of cypress trees in the swamps and bayous of her South Louisiana home.
Isn't that something? I forgot all about her being your niece. Now she's something, all right. Or was,
Reba rudely says again, shoving her short dark hair out of her bloodshot eyes.
Got into some trouble, didn't she?
Fucking dyke, shut up.
Lightning rips the black curtain of night,
and for an instant Nick can see the white daylight on the other side. That's how her father always explained it.
"You see, Nick," he would say, as they gazed out the window during angry storms, and lightning suddenly and without warning cut zigzags like a bright blade. "There's tomorrow, see? You got to look quick, Nick. There's tomorrow on the other side, that bright white light. And see how quick it heals. God heals just that fast."
"Reba, go back to the hotel," Nick tells her in the same firm, controlled voice she uses when Buddy throws a tantrum. "You've had enough whiskey for one night."
"Well, excuse me, you Miss Teacher's pet."
Reba is careening toward unconsciousness, and she talks as if she has rubber bands in her mouth. Nick feels Scarpetta's eyes on her and wishes she could send her a signal that might be reassuring or serve as an apology for Reba's outrageous display. Lucy has entered the room like a hologram, and Scarpetta's subtle but deeply emotional response shocks Nick with jealousy, with envy she didn't know she had. She feels inferior to her hero's super-cop niece, whose talents and world are enormous compared to Nick's. Her heart aches like a frozen joint that is finally unbent, the way her mother gently straightened out Nick's healing broken arm every time the splint came off.
"Hurting's good, baby. If you didn't feel something, this little arm of yours would be dead and fall right off. You wouldn't want that, would you?"
"No, Mama. I'm sorry for what I did."
"Why, Nicky, that's the silliest thing. You didn't hurt yourself on purpose."
"But I didn't do what Papa said. I ran right into the woods, and that's when I tripped."
"We all make mistakes when we're scared, baby. Maybe it's a good thing you fell down. You were low to the ground when the lightning was flying all around."
4. Nick's memories of her childhood in the Deep South are full of storms. It seems the heavens threw terrible fits every week, exploding in rageful thunder and trying to drown or electrocute every living creature on the earth. Whenever thunderheads raised their ugly warnings and boomed their threats, her papa preached about safety, and her pretty blonde mother stood at the screen door, motioning for Nick to hurry into the house, hurry into a warm, dry place, hurry into her arms. Papa always turned off the lights, and the three of them sat in the dark, telling Bible stories and seeing how many verses and psalms they could quote from memory. A perfect recitation was worth a quarter, but her father wouldn't pay out until the storm passed, because quarters are made of metal, and metal attracts lightning. "Thou shalt not covet." Nick's excitement had been almost unbearable when she learned that one of the Academy's visiting lecturers was Dr. Kay Scarpetta, who would teach death investigation the 10th and final week of training. Nick counted the days. She felt as though the first 9 weeks would never pass. Then Scarpetta arrived here in Knoxville, and to Nick's acute embarrassment she met her for the first time in the ladies' room, right after Nick flushed the toilet and emerged from a stall, zipping up the dark navy cargo pants of her battle-dress uniform. Scarpetta was washing her hands at a sink, and Nick recalled the first time she had seen a photograph of her, and how surprised she had been that Scarpetta wasn't of dark Spanish stock. That was about 8 years ago, when Nick knew only Scarpetta's name, and had no reason to expect that she would be a blue-eyed blonde, whose ancestors came from northern Italy, some of them farmers along the Austrian border, and as Aryan in appearance as Germans. "Hi, I'm Dr. Scarpetta," her hero said, as if oblivious that the flushing toilet and Nick were related. "And let me guess, you're Nicole Robillard." Nick turned into a mute, her face bright red.
"How?"
Before she could sputter the rest of the question, Scarpetta explained, "I requested copies of everyone's application, including photographs."
"You did?"
Not only was Nick stunned that Scarpetta would have asked for their applications, but she couldn't fathom why she would have had the time or interest in looking at them.
"Guess that means you know my social security number," Nick tried to be funny.
"Now I don't remember that," Scarpetta said, drying her hands on paper towels. "But I know enough." 5.
Second Instar.
Nick shows off by answering the forgotten question about Maggie the Maggot. The cops around the table shake their heads and cut their eyes at one another. Nick has the capacity to irritate her comrades and has done so on and off for the past 2.5 months. In some ways she reminds Scarpetta of Lucy, who spent the first 20 years of her young life accusing people of slights they hadn't quite committed and flexing her gifts to the extreme of exhibitionism.
"That's very good, Nick," Scarpetta commends her.
"Who invited Smarty Pants?"
Reba, who refuses to return to the Holiday Inn, is just plain obnoxious when she isn't nodding off into her plate.
"I think Nick hasn't been drinking enough and is having the DTs and seeing maggots crawling everywhere," says the detective with the shiny shaved head.
The way he looks at Nick is pretty obvious. Despite her being the class nerd, he is attracted to her.
"And you probably think an instar is a position on a baseball field."
Nick wants to be funny, but can't escape the gravity of her mood.
"See that little maggot I gave Dr. Scarpetta? Ah, at last she confesses.
It's a second instar. Nick knows she should stop. Already shed its skin once since it hatched."
"Oh, yeah? How do you know? You an eyewitness? You actually see little Maggie shed her little skin?"
The detective with the shaved head persists, winking at her.
"Nick's got a tent in the body farm. Sleeps out there with all her creepy crawly friends,"
someone else says.
"I would if I needed to."
No one argues with that. Nick is well known for her ventures into the 2-acre wooded decay research facility at the University of Tennessee, where the decomposition of donated human bodies is studied to determine many important facts of death, not the least of which is when death occurred. The joke is she visits the body farm as if she's dropping by the old folks' home and checking on her relatives.
"But Nick's got a name for every maggot, fly, beetle, and buzzard out there."
The quips and gross-out jokes continue until Reba drops her fork with a loud clatter.
"Not while I'm eating rare steak," she protests much too loudly. "The spinach adds a nice touch of green, girlfriend. Too bad you didn't get no rice. Hey, it ain't too late. Waitress, bring this lady a nice bowl of rice with gravy."
And what are these tiny black dots that look like Maggie's eyes?
Scarpetta lifts the vial to the candlelight again, hoping her students will settle down before they all get kicked out of the restaurant.
"Eyes," says the cop with the shaved head. "They're eyes, right?"
Reba begins to sway in her chair.
"No, they're not eyes," Scarpetta replies.
"Come on. I already gave you a hint a few minutes ago." "Look like eyes to me. Little beady black eyes, like McGill's."
In the past 10 weeks, Sergeant McGill from Houston has become McGilla the Gorilla because of his hairy, muscle-bound body.
"Hey," he protests. "You ask my girlfriend if I got maggot eyes. She looks deep into these eyes of mine," he points to them, "and faints." "Exactly what we're saying, McGilla. I looked into those eyes of yours, I'd pass out cold, too. They gotta be eyes. How the hell else does a maggot see where it's going?"
"They're spiracles, not eyes," Nick answers. "That's what the little black dots are. Like little snorkels so the maggot can breathe."
"Snorkels? Wait a minute. Hey, hand that thing over, Dr. Scarpetta. I want to see if Maggie's wearing a mask and fins."
A skinny state police investigator from Michigan has her head on the table. She is laughing so hard.
"Next time we find a ripe one, just look for little snorkels sticking up."
The guffaws turn to fits, McGilla sliding off his chair, prone on the floor.
"Oh, shit! I'm gonna throw up!" he shrieks with laughter. "Snorkels!"
Scarpetta surrenders, sitting back in silence, the situation out of her control.
"Hey, Nick! Didn't know you were a Navy SEAL!"
This goes on until the manager of Ye Olde Steakhouse silently appears in the doorway, his way of indicating that the party in his back room is disturbing the other diners.
"Okay, boys and girls," Scarpetta says in a tone that is slightly scary.
"Enough."
The hilarity is gone as quickly as a sonic boom. The maggot jokes end. And then there are other gifts for Scarpetta. A space pen that can supposedly write in rain, blizzards, and if you accidentally drop it in a chest cavity while you're doing an autopsy. A mini-mag light to see in those hard-to-reach places. And a dark blue baseball cap embellished with enough gold braid for a general. General Dr. Scarpetta, salute! Everybody does as they eagerly look for her response, irreverent remarks flying around again like shotgun pellets. Megilla tops off Scarpetta's wine glass from a gallon paper carton with a push-button spout. She figures the cheap Chardonnay is probably made from grapes grown at the lowest level of the slopes, where the drainage is terrible. If she's lucky, the vintage is 4 months old. She will be sick tomorrow. She is sure of it. 6. Early the next morning in New York's Kennedy Airport, a security guard recommends that Lucy Farinelli remove her oversized stainless steel Breitling watch, empty her pockets of coins, and place them in a tray. It is not a suggestion, but an order when she is asked to remove her running shoes, jacket, and belt, and place them and her briefcase on the conveyor that will carry them through the X-ray machine, where nothing but a cell phone, a hairbrush, and a tube of lipstick will fluoresce. British air attendants are friendly enough in their dark blazers and navy blue dresses with red and white checks, but airport police are especially tense. Although she doesn't set off the doorframe-shaped scanner as she walks through in her athletic socks, her jeans hanging loose, she is searched with a hand scanner, and her underwire bra sets it off with a beep, beep, beep. "Hold up your arms," the hefty female officer tells her. Lucy smiles and holds out her arms crucifixion style, and the officer pats her down quickly, her hands fluttering under Lucy's arms, under her breasts, up and down her thighs, all the way to her crotch, very professionally, of course. Other passengers pass by unmolested, and the men in particular find the good-looking young woman with arms and legs spread of keen interest. Lucy could care less. She has lived through too much to waste energy in being modest, and is tempted to unbutton her shirt and point out the underwire bra, assuring the officer that no battery and tiny, very tiny, explosive device are attached. "It's my bra," she casually says to the startled guard, who is far more unnerved than her suspect. "Damn it, I always forget to wear a bra without wire in it. Maybe a sports bra, or no bra. I'm really sorry to inconvenience you, Officer Washington." She already read her name tag. "Thank you for doing your job so well. What a world we live in. I understand the terrorist alert is orange again." Lucy leaves the bewildered guard and plucks her watch and coins out of the tray and collects her briefcase, jacket, and belt. Sitting on the cold, hard floor out of the way of traffic, she puts on her running shoes, not bothering to lace them. She gets up, still polite and sweet to any police or British Air employees watching her. Reaching around to her back pocket, she slips out her ticket and passport, both of them issued to one of her many false names. She strolls nonchalantly, laces flopping, deep inside the winding, carpeted Gate 10, and ducks inside the small doorway of Concorde Flight 01. A British Air attendant smiles at her as she checks Lucy's boarding pass. "Seat 1C." She points the way to the first row, the bulkhead aisle seat, as if Lucy has never traveled on the Concorde before. Last time she did, it was under yet another name, and she was wearing glasses and green contact lenses, her hair dyed funky blue and purple, easily washed out, and matching the photograph on that particular passport. Her occupation was musician. Although no one could possibly have been familiar with her non-existent techno band, Yellow Hell, there were plenty of people who said, "Oh, yes, I've heard of it. Cool." Lucy counts on the dismal observation skills of the general masses. She counts on their fear of showing ignorance, on their accepting lies as familiar truths. She counts on her enemies noticing all that goes on around them, and like them, she notices all that goes on around her, too. For example, when the customs agent studied her passport at great length, she recognized his behavior and understood why security is at a feverish pitch. Interpol has sent a red notice screaming over the internet to approximately 182 countries, alerting them to look out for a fugitive named Rocco Caggiano, wanted in Italy and France for murder. Rocco has no idea he is a fugitive. He has no idea that Lucy sent information to Interpol's Central Bureau in Washington, D.C., her credible tip thoroughly checked out before it was relayed through cyberspace to Interpol's headquarters in Lyon, France, where the red notice was issued and rocketed to law enforcement all around the world. All this in a matter of hours. Rocco does not know Lucy, although he knows who she is. She knows him very well, although they have never met. At this moment, as she straps herself into her seat and the Concorde starts its Rolls-Royce engines, she can't wait to see Rocco Caggiano, her anticipation fueled by intense anger that will evolve into a nervous dread by the time she finally gets to Eastern Europe.
7.
I sure hope you're not feeling as bad as I am, Nick says to Scarpetta.
They sit inside the living room of Scarpetta's suite at the Marriott, waiting for room service. It is 9 a.m., and twice now Nick has inquired about Scarpetta's health, her banality partly due to her flattered disbelief that this woman she admires so intensely invited her to have breakfast.
Why me?
The question bounces inside Nick's head like a bingo ball.
Maybe she feels sorry for me.
I felt better, Scarpetta replies with a smile.
Popeye and his wine. But he's brought worse poison than that.
I don't know how anything could be worse, Scarpetta says as a knock sounds on the door. Unless it really is poison, excuse me.
She gets up from the couch. Room service has arrived on a table wheeled inside. Scarpetta signs the check and tips in cash. Nick notes that she is generous.
Popeye's room, room 106, is a watering hole, Nick says. Any night, just go on in with your six-pack and dump it in the bathtub. Starting around 8 p.m., he does nothing but haul 20-pound bags of ice to his room. Good thing he's on the first floor. I went once.
Only once in 10 weeks?
Scarpetta watches her closely, probing. When Nick returns to Louisiana, she will face the worst homicide cases she may ever have in her life. So far, she hasn't said a word about them, and Scarpetta is concerned about her. When I was in medical school at Johns Hopkins, Scarpetta offers as she pours coffee, I was one of three women in my class. If there was a bathtub full of beer anywhere, I can assure you I was never told. What do you take?
Lots of cream and sugar. You shouldn't be serving me. Here I am, just sitting.
She pops up from her wing chair.
Sit down, sit down.
Scarpetta sets Nick's coffee on a table.
There are croissants and rather inedible-looking bagels. I'll let you help yourself. But when you were in medical school, you weren't a small town.
Nick catches herself before saying hick.
Miami's not exactly some little mud puddle in Louisiana. All these guys in my class are from big cities.
She fixes her attention on Scarpetta's coffee cup, on how perfectly steady it is as she lifts it to her lips. She drinks her coffee black and seems uninterested in food.
When my chief told me the department was offered a fully funded slot at the academy and would I go, I can't tell you what I felt like, Nick goes on, worrying that she's talking too much about herself. I really couldn't believe it and had to go to a world of trouble to make it possible for me to leave home for close to 3 months. Then I got here to Knoxville and found myself with Reba as a roommate. I can't say it's been fun, and I feel terrible sitting here and complaining.
She nervously drinks her coffee, setting it down, then picking it up again, clenching her napkin tightly in her lap.
Especially to you.
Why especially to me?
Truth is, I guess I was hoping to impress you.
You have.
And you don't seem the sort to appreciate whining.
Nick looks up at her.
It's not like people are always nice to you, either.
Scarpetta laughs.
Shall I call that an understatement?
That didn't come out right. People are jealous out there. You've had your battles. What I'm saying is, you don't complain.
Ask Rose about that.
Scarpetta is quite amused.
Nick's mind locks, as if she should know who Rose is but can't make a connection.
My secretary, Scarpetta explains, sipping her coffee.
An awkward silence follows, and Nick asks, What happened to the other two?
Scarpetta is confused.
The other two women in your medical class.
One dropped out. I think the other got married and never practiced medicine.
I wonder what they're feeling now.
Probably regret. They probably wonder about me, too, Scarpetta replies. They probably think I feel regret.
Nick's lips part in disbelief.
You? Everything comes with sacrifices, and it's human nature to have a hard time accepting anyone who's different. Usually you don't figure that out until you get what you asked for in life and are shocked that in some instances your reward is hatred instead of applause.
I don't see myself as different or hated. Maybe picked on a lot, but not back home, Nick quickly replies. Just because I'm with a small department instead of LAPD doesn't mean I'm stupid.
Her spirit rises, her voice heating up.
I'm not some mud bug swamp rat redneck.
Mud bug? Scarpetta frowns. I don't believe I know what that is.
A crawfish?
Did someone in the class call you a crawfish?
Nick can't help but lighten up.
Oh, hell. None of them have ever even eaten a crawfish. They probably think it's a fish that crawls along the bottom of the ocean or something.
I see.
I know what you mean, though, sort of, Nick says. In Zachary, only 2 street cops are women. I'm the only female investigator, and it's not that the chief dislikes women or anything like that. In fact, the mayor's a woman. But most times when I'm in the break room getting coffee or eating or whatever, I'm the only woman in there. Truth is, I rarely think about it, but I have thought about it a lot here at the academy. I realize I try too hard to prove I'm really not a hick, and then I annoy everyone. Well, I know you need to go. You probably have to pack, and I don't want you to miss your plane.
Not so fast, Scarpetta replies.
I don't think we're finished talking.
Nick relaxes, her attractive face more animated, her slender body less rigid in the chair. When she speaks this time, she doesn't sound as nervous.
I will tell you the nicest thing anybody's said to me during this entire 10 weeks. Reba said I look a little bit like you. Of course it was when she was drunk.
Hope I didn't just insult you.
You may have insulted yourself, Scarpetta modestly replies. I'm somewhat older than you, if what I read on your application is to be trusted.
36 in August. It's amazing what you pick up about people.
I make it my business to know as much about people as I can. It's important to listen. Most people are too busy making assumptions, too self-absorbed to listen. And in the morgue, my patients speak very quietly, and are unforgiving if I don't listen and find out everything I can about them. Sometimes I don't listen to Buddy like I should, when I'm frantic or just too tired.
Sadness crosses her eyes.
I, of all people, ought to know how that feels, since Ricky hardly ever listened to me, which is one reason we didn't get along, one of many reasons.
Scarpetta has suspected that Nick's marriage is in trouble or has ended. People who are unhappy in relationships carry about them a distinct air of discontent and isolation. In Nick's case, the signs are there, especially the anger that she thinks she hides.
How bad? Scarpetta asks her.
Separated, well on our way to divorce.
Nick reaches for her coffee cup again, but changes her mind.
Thank God my father lives nearby in Baton Rouge, or I don't know what I'd do about Buddy. I know damn well Ricky would take him from me just to pay me back.
Pay you back? For what?
Scarpetta inquires, and she has a reason for all these questions.
A long story. Been going on more than a year, from bad to worse. Not that it was ever all that good.
About as long as these women have been disappearing from your area. Scarpetta finally gets to her point.
I want to know how you're handling that, because it will get you if you let it, when you least expect it. It's not escaped my notice that you haven't brought up the cases once, not while I've been here.
10 women in 14 months. Vanished, from their homes, vehicles, parking lots, all in the Baton Rouge area. Presumed dead.
I can assure you they are. I can assure you they were murdered by the same person, who is shrewd, very shrewd. Intelligent and experienced enough to gain trust, then abduct, then dispose of the bodies. He's killed before, and he'll kill again.
The latest disappearance was just 4 days ago, in Zachary. That makes 2 cases in Zachary, the first one several months ago. So you're going home to that, Nick. Serial murders. 10 of them. Not 10. Just the 2 in Zachary. I'm not on the task force, Nick replies with restrained resentment. I don't run with the big boys. They don't need help from little country cops like me. At least that's the way the U.S. attorney looks at it. What's the U.S. attorney got to do with it? Scarpetta asks. These cases aren't the jurisdiction of the feds. Weldon Wynn's not only an egotistical asshole, but he's stupid. Nothing worse than someone who's stupid and arrogant and has power. The cases are high profile, all over the news. He wants to be part of them, maybe end up a federal judge or senator someday. And you're right. I know what I'm going home to, but all I can do is work the 2 disappearances we've had in Zachary, even if I know damn well they're connected to the other 8. Interesting the abductions are now happening farther north of Baton Rouge, Scarpetta says. He may be finding his earlier killing field too risky. The only thing good I can say about that is Zachary may be in the East Baton Rouge Parish, but at least it isn't the jurisdiction of the Baton Rouge Police. So the High and Mighty Task Force can't boss me around about my cases. Tell me about them. Let's see. The most recent one, what I know about it, what anybody knows about it. 2 days after Easter, just 4 nights ago, she begins. A 40-year-old schoolteacher named Glenda Marler. She's a teacher at the high school, same high school I went to. Blonde, blue-eyed, pretty, very smart, divorced, no children. This past Tuesday night, she goes to the roadside barbecue, gets pulled pork, hush puppies, and slaw to go. She has a 94 Honda Accord, blue, and is observed driving away from the restaurant, south on Main Street, right through the middle of town. She vanishes, her car found abandoned in the parking lot of the high school where she taught. Of course, the task force is suggesting that she was having a rendezvous with one of her students, that the case isn't related to the others, that it's a copycat. Bullshit. Her own high school parking lot, Scarpetta thoughtfully observes. So he talked to her, found out about her after he had her in his car, maybe asked her where she worked, and she told him, or else he stalked her. Which do you think it is? I don't know. Most serial killers stalk their victims, but there's no set rule, despite what most profilers would like to think. The other victim, Nick continues, vanished right before I came here. Ivy Ford. 42 years old, blonde, blue-eyed, attractive, worked as a bank teller. Kids are off in college, and her husband was up in Jackson, Mississippi on a business trip, so she was home alone when someone must have showed up at her door. As usual, no sign of a struggle, no nothing, and she's gone without a trace. Nothing is ever without a trace, Scarpetta says, as she envisions each scenario, contemplating the obvious. The victim has no reason to fear her attacker until it is too late. Is Ivy Ford's house still secured? Scarpetta doubts it after all this time. Family's still living in it. I don't know how people return to homes where such awful things have happened. Nick starts to say that she wouldn't. But that isn't true. Earlier in her life, she did. The car in this most recent case, Glenda Marler's case, is impounded and was thoroughly examined? Scarpetta asks. Hours and hours, we... Well, as you know, I was here. This detail disappoints her. But I've gotten the full report, and I know we spent a lot of time on it. My guys lifted every print they could find, entered the usable ones in APHIS, and no matches. Personally, I don't think that matters because I believe that whoever grabbed Glenda Marler was never inside her car, so his prints wouldn't be in there anyway, and the only prints on the door handles were hers. What about her keys and wallet and any other personal effects? Keys in the ignition, her pocketbook and wallet in the high school parking lot about 20 feet from the car. Money in the wallet? Scarpetta asks. Nick shakes her head. But her checkbook and charge cards weren't touched. She wasn't one to carry much cash. Whatever she had, it was gone, and I know she had at least $6.32 because that was the change she got when she gave the guy at the barbecue a $10 bill to pay for her food. I had my guys check, because oddly the bag of food wasn't inside her car, so there was no receipt. We had to go back to the barbecue and have him pull her receipt. Then it would appear that the perpetrator took her food, too. This is odd, more typical of a burglary or robbery, certainly not the usual in a psychopathic violent crime. As far as you know, is robbery involved in the cases of the other 8 missing women? Scarpetta asks. Rumor has it that their billfolds were cleaned out of cash and tossed not far from where they were snatched. No fingerprints in any of the cases, as far as you know? I don't know for a fact. Perhaps DNA from skin cells where the perpetrator touched the billfold? I don't know what the Baton Rouge police have done, because they don't tell anybody shit. But the guys at my department swabbed everything we could, including Ivy Ford's wallet, and did get her DNA profile, and another one that isn't in the FBI's database, CODIS. Louisiana, as you know, is just getting started on a DNA database and is so backed up on entering samples you may as well forget it. But you do have an unknown profile, Scarpetta says with interest. Although we have to accept right off that it could be anybody's. What about her children? Her husband? The DNA's not theirs. Scarpetta nods. Then you have to start wondering who else would have had good reason to touch Ivy Ford's wallet. Who else besides the killer? I wonder about that 24 hours a day. And this most recent case, Glenda Marler? The state police labs have the evidence. The test results will be a while, even though there's a rush on them. An alternate light source used on the inside of the car? Yes! Nothing, 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 Nick says in frustration. No crime scenes, no bodies, like it's all a bad dream. If even just one body would show up. The coroner's great. You've heard of him? Dr. Sam Lanier? Scarpetta doesn't know him. 8. The East Baton Rouge Parish Coroner's Office overlooks a long, straight reach of the Mississippi River and the former Art Deco state capital, where the wily, fearless, and despotic Huey Long was assassinated. Muddy, sluggish water carries Dr. Sam Lanier's eye to a riverboat casino and past the USS Kidd battleship to the distant old Mississippi Bridge as he stands before his office window on the 5th floor of the governmental building. He is a fit man in his early 60s with a head of gray hair that naturally parts neatly on the right side. Unlike most men of his power, he shuns suits except when he is in court or attending the political functions he cannot avoid. His may be a political office, but he despises politics and virtually all people involved in it. Contrary by nature, Dr. Lanier wears the same outfit pretty much every day, even if he's meeting with the mayor. Comfortable shoes capable of walking him into unpleasant places, dark slacks, and a polo shirt embroidered with the East Baton Rouge Parish Coroner's crest. Deliberate man that he is, he ponders how to handle the bizarre communication he received yesterday morning, a letter enclosed in a National Academy of Justice postage-paid mailing. Dr. Lanier has been a member of the organization for years. The large, white NAJ envelope was sealed. It did not look tampered with in any way until Dr. Lanier opened it and found another envelope, also sealed. It was addressed to him by hand in block printing, the return address, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, Polunsky Unit. A search on the Internet revealed that the Polunsky Unit is death row. The letter, also written by hand in block printing, reads, "Greetings, Monsieur Lanier. Of course you remember Madame Charlotte Dard, whose untimely sad death occurred on 14 December 1995. You witnessed her autopsy, and I do envy you for that delicious experience, having never seen one myself, not in person. I will be executed soon and am relieving myself of secrets. Madame Dard was murdered very cleverly, mais non, not by me. A person of interest, as they stupidly refer to possible suspects these days, fled to Palm Desert shortly after Madame Dard's death. This person is not there now. This person's location and identity you must discover for yourself. I very much encourage you to seek assistance. Might I suggest the great skills of Detective Pete Marino? He knows me very well from my joyous Richmond days. Surely you must have heard of the great Marino? Your surname, mon cher monsieur, implies you are of French descent. Perhaps we are related. A bientôt. Jean-Baptiste Chandon. Dr. Lanier has heard of Jean-Baptiste Chandon. He has not heard of Pete Marino, but is introduced to him easily enough by sending out a few search engines to chug through cyberspace and find him. It is true. Marino led the investigation when Chandon was murdering women in Richmond. What interests Dr. Lanier more, however, is that Marino is best known for his close professional relationship with Dr. K. Scarpetta, a gifted forensic pathologist. Dr. Lanier has always respected her and was more than a little impressed when he heard her lecture at a regional meeting of coroners. Most forensic pathologists, particularly ones with her status, look down on coroners, think they're all funeral home directors who got voted into office. Of course, some of them are. Trouble stuck out its big foot and tripped Dr. Scarpetta, hurting her badly several years back. For that, she has Dr. Lanier's sympathy. Not a day goes by when Trouble doesn't stomp around looking for him, too. Now some notorious serial killer seems to think he needs the help of her colleague, Marino. Maybe he does. Maybe he's being set up. With the election not even 6 months away, Dr. Lanier is suspicious of any deviation from routine, and a letter from Jean-Baptiste Chandon makes him as leery as hell. The only reason he can't dismiss it is simple. Jean-Baptiste Chandon, if the letter is really from him, knows about Charlotte Dard. Her case has been forgotten by the public and was never all that newsworthy outside of Baton Rouge. Her death was undetermined. Dr. Lanier has always entertained the possibility that she was murdered. He's always believed that the best way to identify Cottonmouth is to poke at it. If the inside of its mouth is white, whack off its head. Otherwise, the critter's nothing more than a harmless water snake. He may as well poke at the truth and see what he finds. While sitting at his desk, he picks up the phone and discovers Marino doesn't care who finds him. He has what Dr. Lanier calls a bring-em-on attitude. He envisions Marino as the type who would ride a fat boy Harley, probably without a helmet. The cop's answering machine doesn't say he can't answer the phone because he's not in or is on the other line, which is what most professional polite people record as greetings. The recorded gruff male voice says, "Don't call me at home," and offers another number for the person to try. Dr. Lanier tries the other number. The voice that answers sounds like the recorded one.
"Detective Marino? Who wants to know?"
He's from New Jersey and doesn't trust anyone. Probably doesn't like hardly anyone either. Dr. Lanier introduces himself, and he's careful about what he says, too. In the trust and like department, Marino's met his match.
"We had a death down here about 8 years ago. You ever heard of a woman named Charlotte Dodd?"
"Nope."
Dr. Lanier gives him a few details of the case.
"Nope."
Dr. Lanier gives him a few more.
"Let me ask you something. Why the hell would I know anything about some drug overdose in Baton Rouge?"
Marino's not at all nice about it.
"Same question I have."
"Huh? What is this? Are you some asshole bullshitting me?"
"A lot of people think I'm an asshole," Dr. Lanier replies. "But I'm not bullshitting you."
He debates whether he should tell Marino about the letter from Jean-Baptiste Chandon. He decides that no useful purpose would be served. He's already found out what he needed to know. Marino is clueless about Charlotte Dard and annoyed at being bothered by some coroner.
"One other quick question, and then I won't take up any more of your time," Dr. Lanier says. "You have a long history with Dr. K. Scarpetta. What's she got to do with this?"
Marino's entire demeanor changes. Now he's just plain hostile.
"I understand she's doing private consulting."
Dr. Lanier had read a brief mention of it on the internet. Marino doesn't respond.
"What do you think of her?"
Dr. Lanier asks the question that he feels sure will trigger a volcanic temper.
"Tell you what, asshole? I think enough of her not to talk about her with some shitbag stranger."
The call ends with a dial tone. In Sam Lanier's mind, he couldn't have gotten a stronger validation of Dr. K. Scarpetta's character. She's welcome down here. 9. Scarpetta waits in line at the Marriott's front desk, her head throbbing, her central nervous system shorted out by wine so terrible it ought to have a skull and crossbones on the label. Her malady, her malaise, is far more serious than she ever let on to Nick, and with each passing minute her physical condition and mood worsen. She refuses to diagnose her illness as a hangover. After all, she barely had 2 glasses of that goddamn wine, and she refuses to forgive herself for even considering an alcoholic beverage sold in a cardboard box. Painful experience has proven for years that when she suffers such merry misadventures, the more coffee she drinks, the more awful she's going to feel. But this never stops her from ordering a large pot in her room and flying by the seat of her pants instead of trusting her instruments, as Lucy likes to say, when her aunt ignores what she knows and does what she feels and crash lands. When she finally reaches the front desk, she asks for her bill and is handed an envelope. "This just came in for you, ma'am," the harried receptionist says as he tears off the printout of her room charges and hands it to her. Inside the envelope is a fax. Scarpetta walks behind the bellman, pushing her cart. It is loaded with bags and 3 very large hard cases containing carousels of slides that she has not bothered to convert to PowerPoint presentations because she can't stand them. Showing a picture of a man who has blown off the top of his head with a shotgun or a child scalded to death does not require a computer and special effects. Slide presentations and handouts serve her purposes just as well now as they did when she started her career. The fax is from her secretary, Rose, who must have called about the same time Scarpetta was miserably making her way from the elevator to the lobby. All Rose says is that Dr. Sam Lanier, the coroner of East Baton Rouge Parish, very much needs to speak to her. Rose includes his home, office, and cell telephone numbers. Immediately, Scarpetta thinks of Nick Robillard, of their conversation not even an hour ago. She waits until she is inside her taxi before calling Dr. Lanier's office number. He answers himself. "How did you know who my secretary is and where to reach her?" she asks right off.
"Your former office in Richmond was kind enough to give me your number in Florida. Rose is quite charming, by the way."
"I see," she replies as the taxi drives away from the hotel. "I'm in a taxi on the way to the airport. Can we make this quick?" Her abruptness is more about her annoyance with her former office than with him. Giving out her unlisted phone number is blatant harassment. Not that it hasn't happened before. Some people who still work at the chief medical examiner's office remain loyal to their boss. Others are traitors and bend in the direction that power pulls.
"Quick it will be," Dr. Lanier says. "I'm wondering if you would review a case for me, Dr. Scarpetta. An 8-year-old case that was never successfully resolved. A woman died under suspicious circumstances, apparently from a drug overdose. You ever heard of Charlotte Dodd?"
"No."
"I've just gotten information, don't know if it's good or not, but I don't want to discuss it while you're on a cell phone."
"This is a Baton Rouge case?" Scarpetta digs in her handbag for a notepad and pen.
"Another story for another day, but yes, it's a Baton Rouge case."
"Your case?"
"It was. I'd like to send you the reports, slides, and all the rest. Looks like I'd better dig back into this thing."
He hesitates.
"And as you might suspect, I don't have much of a budget."
"Nobody who calls me has consultants built into the budget," she interrupts him. "I didn't either when I was in Virginia." She tells him to FedEx her the case and gives him her address. She adds, "Do you happen to know an investigator in Zachary named Nick Robillard?" A pause, then,
"Believe I talked to her on the phone a few months back. I'm sure you know what's going on down here."
"I can't help but know." "It's all over the news," Scarpetta cautiously replies, over the noise of the taxi and rush hour traffic. Neither her tone nor her words betray that she has any personal information about the cases, and her trust of Nick slips several notches as she frets that perhaps Nick called Dr. Lanier and talked about her. Why she might have done that is hard to say, unless she simply volunteered that Scarpetta could be a very useful resource for him, should he ever need her. Maybe he really does need her for this cold case he's just told her about. Maybe he's trying to develop a relationship with her because he's not equipped to handle these serial murders by himself. How many forensic pathologists work for you? Scarpetta asks him.
One.
Did Nick Robillard call you about me? She doesn't have time for subtlety.
Why would she?
That's no answer.
Hell no, he says.
10. An air conditioning unit rattles in a dusty window, the afternoon hotter than usual for April as J. Tally hacks meat into small pieces and drops them into a bloody plastic bucket below the scarred wooden table where he sits. The table, like everything else inside his fishing shack, is old and ugly, the sort of household objects people leave at the edges of their driveways to be picked up by garbage collectors or spirited away by scavengers. His workspace is his special place, and he is patient as he repeatedly adjusts torn bits of clothing that he jams under several of the table legs in his ongoing attempt to keep the table level. He prefers not to chop on a surface that moves, but balance is virtually impossible in his warped little world, and the graying wood floor slopes enough to roll an egg from the kitchenette right out to the dock, where some planks are rotted, others curled like dull dead hair flipped up at the ends. Swatting at sea gnats, he finishes a Budweiser, crushes the can, and hurls it out the open screen door, pleased that it sails 20 feet past his boat and plops into the water. Boredom gives pleasure to the most mundane activities, including checking on the crab pots suspended from floats in the murky fresh water. It doesn't matter that crabs aren't found in fresh water. Crawfish are, and they're in season. And if they don't pick the pots clean, something bigger usually comes along. Last month a large log turned into an alligator gar, wearing at least 100 pounds. It moved like a torpedo, speeding off with a trot line and its makeshift float of an empty Clorox bottle. Jay sat calmly in his boat and tipped his baseball cap to the carnivorous creature. Jay doesn't eat what he catches in the pots, but out here in the middle of this hellish nowhere he now calls home, his only acceptable fresh choices are catfish, bass, turtles, and as many frogs as he can gig at night. Otherwise, his food comes in bags and cans from various grocery stores on the mainland. He brings down a meat cleaver, cutting through muscle and bone. More pieces of foul flesh land in the bucket. It doesn't take long for meat to rot in this heat.
"Guess who I'm thinking about right now," he says to Bev Kiffin, his woman.
"Shut up. You say that just to get me."
"No, mon chéri. I say it because I'm remembering fucking her in Paris."
Jealousy flares. Bev can't control herself when she is forced to think of Kay Scarpetta, who is fine-looking and smart, plenty fine-looking and smart enough for Jay. Rarely does it occur to Bev that she has no good reason to compete with a woman Jay fantasizes about chopping up and feeding to the alligators and crawfish in the bayou outside their door. If Bev could cut Scarpetta's throat, she sure as hell would, and her own dream is to one day get her chance. Then Jay wouldn't talk about the bitch anymore. He wouldn't stare out at the bayou half the night thinking about her.
"How come you have to always talk about her?"
Bev moves closer to him and watches sweat trickle down his perfectly sculpted, smooth chest, soaking the waistband of his tight, cut-off jeans. She stares at his muscular thighs, the hair on them fine and shiny as gold. Her fury heats to flash over and erupts.
"You got a damn hard on. You chop away and get a stiff dick. Put down that meat axe."
"It's a cleaver, honey. If only you weren't so stupid."
His handsome face and blonde hair are wet with sweat, his cold blue eyes bright against his tan. She bends over and cups her thick, stubby hand around the bulge between his thighs as he calmly spreads his legs wide and leans back in the chair long enough for her to get started on his zipper. She wears no bra, her cheap flower-printed blouse halfway unbuttoned, offering him a view of heavy, flaccid breasts that arouse nothing beyond his need to manipulate and control. He rips open her blouse, buttons lightly clattering against wood, and begins fondling her the way she craves.
"Oh," she moans.
"Don't stop," she begs, moving his head closer.
"Want more, baby?"
"Oh."
He sucks her, disgusted by her salty, sour taste, and shoves her hard with his bare feet. The thud of her body hitting the floor, her shocked gasp, are familiar sounds in the fishing shack. 11. Blood seeps from a scrape on Bev's dimpled left knee, and she stares at the wound.
"How come you don't want me no more, baby?"
she says. "You used to want me so bad I couldn't keep you off me." Her nose runs. She shoves back her short, frizzy, graying brown hair and pulls her torn blouse together, suddenly humiliated by her ugly nakedness. "Want is when I want." He resumes the blows with the meat cleaver. Tiny bits of flesh and bone fly out from the thick, shiny blade and stick to the stained wooden table and to Jay's sweaty, bare chest. The sweet, sour stench of rotting flesh is heavy in the stifling air, and flies drone in lazy zigzags, lumbering airborne like fat cargo planes. They hover over the gory motherlode inside the bucket, their black and green swarming bodies shimmering like spilled gasoline. Bev collects herself off the floor. She watches Jay hacking and tossing flesh into the bucket, flies darting up and greedily dive-bombing back to their feast. They buzz loudly, bumping against the side of the bucket.
"And now we're supposed to eat off that table?"
Hers is an old line. They never eat off it. The table is Jay's private space, and she knows not to touch it. He swats furiously at the sea gnats.
"God damn, I hate these fucking things. When the fuck are you going shopping? And next time, don't come back here with only 2 bottles of insect repellent and no pups."
Bev disappears into the lavatory. It is no bigger than the head on a small boat, and there is no tank to chemically store and treat human waste, which slops through a hole into a washtub between pilings that support the shack. Once a day she empties the tub into the bayou. Her persistent nightmare is that a water moccasin or alligator is going to get her while she sits on the wooden box toilet, and at especially uneasy times she squats above it, peering down at the black hole, her fat thighs shaking from fear and the strain of supporting her weight. She was fleshy when Jay first met her at a campsite near Williamsburg, Virginia, where his family business brought them together by accident, really. He needed a place, and hers was out of the way, an overgrown, garbage-strewn, densely wooded property with abandoned, rusting campers, and a motel mostly patronized by prostitutes and drug lords. When Jay appeared at Bev's door, she was thrilled by his power and was instantly attracted to him. She came on to him the same way she did with all men. Rough, raw sex, her only means of gratifying her lonely, angry needs. The rain had been driving down that night, reminding her of shiny nails, and she fixed Jay a bowl of Campbell's vegetable beef soup and a grilled cheese sandwich, while her young children hid and watched their mother involving herself with yet another stranger. Bev paid her little ones no mind at the time. She tries not to think about them now, or wonder how big they're getting. They are wards of the state, and far better off without her. Ironically, Jay was nicer to them than she was. He was so different then, when he took her to bed that first night. 3 years ago, she was more attractive and had not gained weight from eating snack foods and processed cheeses and meats that don't spoil. She can't do push-ups and squats all day long the way Jay does, and she gets no exercise. Behind the shack, grass flats thick with mussels and rich black muck stretch for miles. There is no dry ground to walk on except the pier. Maneuvering Jay's boat through narrow waterways burns few calories. A small outboard motor would do, but Jay will have nothing less than a 200-horsepower Evinrude with a stainless steel prop to speed through channels, heading to his secret spots, and drift silently beneath cypress trees, waiting perfectly still like a possum if a helicopter or small plane flies low overhead. He helps Bev with nothing. His distinctive looks impossible to disguise because he is too vain to ruin his beauty. When he goes to shore, it is to get money at a family hideaway and not to run errands. Bev can venture out for provisions because she scarcely resembles her photograph on the FBI's most wanted list, her skin withered by the sun, her body overblown, her face puffy and hair cut short. "Why can't we close the door?" Bev asks as she walks out of the tiny, dirty bathroom. He goes to the refrigerator, rounded and white with spots of rust left over from the 60s. Swinging open the door, he grabs another beer.
"I like being hot," he says, his footsteps heavy on the old planking.
"The air conditioning's going right out the door."
Hers is the usual complaint.
"We only got so much gasoline for the generator."
"Then you'll just have to go out and get more. How many times do I have to tell you to get your fat ass out to get more?"
He stares at her, his eyes weird the way they get when he is engrossed in his ritual. His arousal strains against his zipper, and soon he will relieve it, again at a time of his choosing. Body odor and a rotten stench waft past her as he carries the bucket outside, flies storming after it in a loud, buzzing blitzkrieg. He busies himself pulling up crab pots by their yellow nylon ropes. He has dozens of pots. He simply tosses pieces too big to fit inside them into the water, where gators will drag them to the bottom and feed off them at their pleasure. Skulls pose the biggest problem because they make identity certain. Another ritual of his is to pound skulls into dust, which he mixes with powdered white chalk that he stores in empty paint cans. Chalky, bony dust reminds him of the catacombs that wind 25 meters below the streets of Paris. Now inside and flopping on the narrow bed against a wall, he puts his hands behind his head. Bev slips out of her torn blouse, teasing him like a stripper. A master at the waiting game, he does not react as she brushes against his lips. She throbs unbearably. This might go on for a very long time. Never mind her begging, and when he is ready, and only then, he bites, but not hard enough to leave a mark, because he can't abide the idea of being anything like Jean-Baptiste, his brother. Jay used to smell and taste so good. Now that he is a fugitive, he rarely bathes, and when he does, he simply dumps buckets of bayou water over his body. Bev dares not complain or react in the slightest way to the strong stench of his breath and groin. The one and only time she gagged, he broke her nose and forced her to finish, her blood and small cries of pain giving him pleasure. When she cleans the shack, she obsessively scrubs that spot below the bed, but the bloodstains are stubborn, like something out of a horror movie, she thinks. Bleach has left a mottled, whitish-brown area the size of a doormat that Jay constantly complains about, as if he had nothing to do with how it got there.
This book is continued on Disc 2.